Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Trump tweeting out, "Denuclearization will be a great thing for the world, but also for North Korea," after announcing that his head of the CIA, Mike Pompeo, who is awaiting Senate confirmation as the next Secretary of State, secretly visited North Korea and met with Kim Jong-un to lay the groundwork for a summit meeting between Trump and Kim. A former U.S. ambassador to South Korea, Donald Gregg, who served as Vice President George H.W. Bush's National Security Advisor, joins us to discuss how it is likely the summit will take place, but exactly what denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula means remains as unclear as it will be difficult to achieve. We'll look into whether a peace treaty to end the Korean War will be on the table. And since Donald Gregg is close to former President George H.W. Bush and knew Barbara Bush well, we will get his impressions and memories of the former First Lady, who passed away yesterday and today is being remembered as tributes pour in. Then, with Cuba's Communist Party poised to announce a successor to Raul Castro tomorrow, we will assess the new leader, 57-year-old Miguel Díaz-Canel Bermúdez, who is the first outside of the Castro dynasty, which has ruled the country since the revolution over 50 years ago. Mark Frank, a freelance journalist based in Cuba who writes for Reuters and the Financial Times and is the author of Cuban Revelations Behind the Scenes in Havana, joins us to discuss how the internet-savvy Díaz-Canel can go about modernizing Cuba's moribund economy and getting the country more connected to the world, as the U.S. under Trump turns back the clock to impose more isolation on the island nation. Then finally, we will speak with Anne Louise Bardak, the author of Cuba Confidential, Love and Vengeance in Miami and Havana, and Without Fidel, A Death Foretold in Miami, Havana, and Washington. She joins us to discuss how the expectations of young Cubans can be met in terms of both wanting the social services the government provides, but also wanting to be free of a government that won't give them access to the outside world or let them travel and has them under constant surveillance. And joining us now is Donald Gregg, a career CIA officer who served as Vice President George H.W. Bush's National Security Advisor and United States Ambassador to South Korea. In 2007, the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies established a foreign policy fellowship in the ambassador's name, and his latest book is Potsherds, Fragments of a Life Lived in CIA, the White House, and the Two Koreas. Welcome to Background Briefing, Donald Gregg.
Delighted to be with you.
And Ambassador, what do you make of the secret trip that took place over Easter with the outgoing head of the CIA meeting apparently with Kim Jong-un in North Korea? The president made an announcement yesterday in a photo opportunity with the Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe. The president said it happened last week, but apparently it happened earlier than that. But it was conducted in secret, and it seems a little odd for somebody that's a lame duck at the CIA and not yet our chief diplomat, our Secretary of State, to be on this mission. What's your impression?
Well, I first have to say my hat's off to them for being able to have somebody go in secret to Pyongyang without it leaking. That's hard to do. And maybe it was easier to do because they chose a rather unlikely person to send. I am not overly impressed by anything that this administration has done in terms of diplomacy, and these recent maneuvers seem to be rather bizarre to me, given the fact that we don't have a formal ambassador to North Korea or to South Korea, and that so many of our diplomatic posts are vacant.
Well, it seems, though, that it's quite likely that Mike Pompeo will not get the confirmation via the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The full Senate may well approve his nomination. So not getting the vote in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee is, I think, unprecedented and a little embarrassing, isn't it?
Absolutely. Now, has that been formally announced today?
No, it hasn't been announced, but that's the head count at this point.
What is the head count at this point?
Well, you've got, apparently, on the Republican side, Rand Paul opposes him, and then pretty much all the Democrats. So I believe that it's pretty close, if not going to go against him.
Well, I'm not really surprised at that. I mean, I think, as I say, I've just not been very much impressed by anything that this administration has done in terms of diplomacy. And I think they the worse it gets, the less likely they are to have really talented people flock to them saying, oh, yes, I certainly want to work for this president, and I want to be able to tell my grandchildren that this is what I did. That's not going to happen. And I think it's highly unfortunate, and I think that we have a difficult 3 years ahead of us.
Well, on the other hand, maybe because he's so unorthodox, the current president, that he might be able to pull this deal off. That's what a lot of people are saying. But at the same time, we don't know what kind of a deal it is. And if it's about denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula, which is what we've been told is sort of what's in the works there, that's pretty complicated, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And so I have, having said what I just said, I sort of undercut myself by saying we should not demonize Mr. Trump. A stopped clock is right twice a day, and in this case, he may actually accomplish something, and if so, more credit to him. But certainly the denuclearization is something that I think we can do. The North Koreans are not suicidal. They know that if they launch anything really high-tech toward us, we are likely to virtually obliterate their country. They're not going to do that. So that we have, in my view, a soluble problem to address here. It's much, much easier than anything we are trying to do in the long-running conflicts in the Middle East. So I'm no fan of these people, but I would be very glad to see them accomplish something in working toward the denuclearization issue, because I think that can be accomplished.
So just in terms of the complication, though, of denuclearizing the whole peninsula, it's highly unlikely, I would think, given the enormous investments that Kim Jong-un and the North Koreans have made in their nuclear program, to give it up entirely. But if that's a possibility, then, you know, hats off to Pompeo and Trump. But on the other hand, wouldn't it also imply the South Koreans giving up the nuclear umbrella that the United States provides?
Well, it would depend upon if that was a demand put out by the North Koreans that they do that, then I think we would have a less benign attitude toward the negotiation. Now, I think that there are certainly ways that North Korea has developed nuclear weapons to keep us from blowing them out of the water. They are very frank about that. And they are saying if we become convinced that you don't intend to do that, we will be willing to talk about denuclearization. But some of the nuclear developments can be diverted from away from weapons into power generation or other areas, so that all of the money that has been spent is not necessarily wasted. I think what needs to happen is that the Trump administration sort of shows enough of itself and some consistency and some intelligence to begin to win some degree of confidence from our foreign friends and our foreign would-be friends. There hasn't been much of that going on. I think Pompeo is not a particularly attractive figure in that way, but I think it's going to be hard to get really stalwart people to sign on for working for Trump, at least now, until he has not accomplished much in this area.
Well, how do you think the South Koreans feel about it? Now, we can talk about how Abe feels. He didn't look entirely comfortable at the photo opportunity in Mar-a-Lago yesterday.
He looked as though he was looking forward to teeing off,
but,
and not much else.
But to begin with, it was the South Korean National Intelligence Service head, Soo Hoon, who went to North Korea at the time of the Winter Olympics and then showed up at the White House. Apparently, he was in the executive office building when he was summoned into the Oval Office, and suddenly He told Trump that the North Koreans were interested in having a summit, and Trump immediately agreed, which apparently stunned the South Koreans. Is that your understanding of how this deal got in motion?
Yes, it is. It's very bizarre. And I don't know who greased the skids to get him into the Oval Office in the first place. And I don't know what led up to that. So that, the people who are involved are more adroit than I have given them credit for. But it's a very strange series of events that have taken place.
And what about this idea that's now being floated that on the agenda is not just a nuclear deal, which is in itself a pretty high bar, but a formal ending of the Korean War, which, of course, operates still under an armistice, and thus the theatrics that go on daily at Panmunjom?
Well, I mean, I think that is something that is tremendously overdue. I think people are surprised to hear that there's just an armistice agreement. You know, people forget about things. They've lasted for so long. So there is something that certainly could be done better. And I think, anything that gets us away from just a truce agreement to something permanent is very much in interest of the whole region. And so more power to them if they can do it. But the characters they have lined up to become involved are, to me, rather strange and not terribly confidence-inspiring.
On which, our side or on both sides?
Both sides. But more on ours than on the South Koreans or the North Koreans. I think I've been impressed by the North Koreans. I think Kim Jong-un is a very talented, risk-taking young man who's going to be around for a long, long time. And I think if we can gradually establish some sort of relationship of some confidence with him, that will do us and do the Koreans a lot of good, because we're going to be dealing him with for the next 20 years at least.
Well, but isn't there, obviously, there's a tremendous difference between North and South Korea economically, politically, and even militarily, even though North Korea is a kind of garrison state. How does a deal take place that wouldn't, at the end of the day, bring about more contact between the North and the South? And the understanding I've always had is that the North is very afraid of its people learning about the high standard of living in the South. Apparently, pirated copies of South Korean soap operas end up in the North, and the authorities arrest people and send them to the gulag if they're caught. The electricity turns off and the cassette gets jammed in the player, and the people are arrested. So that would indicate to me that they're afraid of bursting the kind of propaganda bubble that North Koreans endure from cradle to grave.
Well, that's a very interesting point you raise, because I've been to North Korea 6 times and in over a 12-year gap. And the first time I went was in 2002, and it was a pretty sad place, Pyongyang was. The roads were lousy. There were just rusty old trucks rustling around. The food was poor. The hotel I stayed in had been built by the Japanese and had somehow not been bombed. It was a pretty decrepit place. And in the 6 times I have been there, the last time being in 2014, it's changed completely. And the last time I was there, the Pyongyang has become quite an attractive city with a lot of new and seemingly well-constructed buildings. There are new cars on the road. The people are dressed better. The food is delicious. And I feel very comfortable going there. So as that has happened, the North Koreans have become more confident about themselves and their own future. And I think that's a very good thing to have happened, and I think it will make it easier for them to deal with, assuming that the South Koreans are deal with them with care and don't look down at them in a kind of condescending fashion.
But the United Nations has written some very damning reports about North Korea's human rights situation and the amount of political prisoners in their gulags. Will that change? Will that moderate?
I think it absolutely will change. I think that as we have seen other sort of troglodyte states change, they have changed as they are aware that they need to change if they're going to become a full-fledged member of the family of nations. And I think that's beginning to start with North Korea as of now. And I base that upon the conversations I've had with the North Koreans and the observations I have seen going in and out of their country for six times over a 12-year period.
And in terms of those that might be brokering this deal, or at least having some tangential arrangement in this deal, often, of course, we turn to China as though China can get our irons out of the fire. And there's also talk of Russia helping out. On both counts, China is now being threatened with a trade war, and Russia, of course, things are very tense, although the latest round of sanctions was reversed by President Trump, which is certainly raises lots of questions about what kind of relationship Trump has with Putin or what kind of hold Putin has over Trump. But my sense is that the Russians probably don't have much to do with this, nor did the Chinese. This is actually something that's going to be totally bilateral between the U.S. and North Korea. Is that your understanding?
I would agree with that. And I think it's healthy that people like you and me are beginning to think that way. Because I think that deals made by two countries because they see it's in their advantage to make a deal are much more likely to be lasting than something sort of put over their heads by foreign intervention or foreign support or foreign beleaguerment that they sort of go along with because they can't find a way to oppose it. So I think this is rather healthy, what's happening, what you just described.
Well, but on the other hand, I think some foreign policy experts are pretty skeptical. Donald Trump seems to be more interested in the cosmetics and looking good. He spends an awful lot of time looking at himself on television, you know, sometimes up to 8 hours a day. And so if you've got two sort of narcissists making a deal, it may be more cosmetic than substantive.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, and I find it very difficult to talk about this because I don't like Trump. I don't admire him. I wish he weren't our president. But it still is quite possible that something good may come out of his administration if he plays along with some forces that are now working more naturally between North and South Korea.
Well, obviously the victory here would be, and we've got to this point because the North Koreans have reached a point, apparently, not necessarily they've tested their nuclear tipped missiles, but they've certainly tested nuclear weapons and they've tested missiles. And the assumption is that they have the ability to now strike American cities. So to get rid of that threat is a very important, obviously. But on the other hand, it would indicate that that may well be what the North Koreans are up to. In other words, you get to the point where you threaten the U.S. and then so the question would be, what are the sweeteners? If you look, for example, at the deal with Iran under Obama, the Iranians, the mere threat that they would go nuclear brought about the end of sanctions. So in this case, it would seem that the North Koreans hold more cards.
Well, that's complicated because I think that the Iran agreement is one of the best we've struck. It's very tenuous, very difficult, very unpopular, but I think it does a hell of a lot of good. So I think with the North Koreans, we're dealing with less sophisticated people, and I think they are, you know, I'm not sure yet what to make of them, how skilled they're going to be in sort of making themselves more acceptable to their neighbors and to the family of nations in that part of the world. They're making some moves in that direction. I think we ought to encourage that, but I'm not sure how far it's going to get.
What do you think there are sweeteners involved?
Inducements. Sweeteners.
Inducements on our part or on the part of the South Koreans? Or
even— yeah, I think so. I mean, well, I think the biggest inducement is to make the North Koreans feel more secure in that we're not going to blow them out of the water. I mean, I've talked to the North Koreans, and they say every time we fly nuclear-capable bomber anywhere in their area, they just, you know, it just scares the hell out of them. I mean, they remember that MacArthur wanted to drop a necklace of nuclear weapons around across North Korean Peninsula. It's taken them a long time to get over that, and I don't think they're really over it yet, because I think we are regarded by them as an existential threat, and it's going to it's going to take them a while and some skilled diplomacy on our part to sort of deal with us in a more normal fashion.
And, of course, you mentioned earlier when you first went there, you stayed in a Japanese hotel. That would have been built during the colonial period of Japanese occupation, and that probably would have been one of the few buildings that survived the U.S. bombing of North Korea during the Korean War.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, Ambassador Gregg, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate your
time. Well, not at all. I'm not sure how coherent I've been on this, but it's very murky.
Right. Well, I agree, and I'm conflicted because on the one hand, I wish Donald Trump were not our president, as you do. I wish he would go away, but this deal may actually help him stay in the Oval Office.
Right. Well, you and I are exactly on the same wavelength on that, so thank you for saying so.
Well, just in closing, I was going to ask you about the First Lady, Barbara Bush, just passed. There's a great deal of attention now being paid to her legacy. Did you ever know her at all?
Oh, I knew her very well. I was her husband's national security advisor for 6.5 years. I went to 65 countries with the Bushes. And I knew Barbara very well. She was a wonderful woman with a great sense of humor. And, I mean, she... we were in London and at a big garden party given by our ambassador there, and there were some very high society people there, and Mrs. Bush sort of became offended by one woman who was swanning around in a very sort of extreme dress, and she called me over and said, "Don, Madame Bovary," we'll call her Madame Bovary, that's not who she was, but I'm not going to say who she was. She said, "Madame Bovary has forgotten to put on her brassiere, and I want you to go over and tell her that." I said, "Mrs. Bush, I would charge a machine gun nest in your defense, but I haven't the courage to go over and tell Madame Bovary that she has forgotten to put on her brassiere." And Mrs. Bush said, "Well, I am deeply, deeply disappointed in you." And that's sort of one of my favorite stories about her. But she was capable of doing that kind of thing, a great sense of humor.
So when you hear that the Bush family, the granddaughter said this, Jenna, that she was known within the family as the enforcer, did she play a bigger role behind the scenes in her husband's presidency?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, she was a solid, solid person. And you really had to know what you were talking about to talk with her. And if she thought that you were leading in a direction that might do some damage to her, you know, to her husband, she was like a tigress. So she was a force to be reckoned with. And delightful if you were able to sort of get through to her, as I eventually did. Some people didn't. And she could make life miserable for you if she felt that you were not doing a good job in terms of furthering our objectives diplomatically.
Well, there were reports, though, that she didn't get on well with Nancy Reagan. Was that your impression?
I think so. I think they were very, very different people. I mean, Nancy was difficult to talk to, and they were very, very different women. And for them to have gotten along, very easily and in a friendly fashion would have been, I think, unexpected given where they came from, who they were, what their backgrounds were, the clothes they wore, the things that were important to them.
Well, Ambassador Gregg, I thank you for your insight in having known the First Lady who just passed.
Well, and I think, you know, I think, I hate to say this, but I don't think her husband is going to last much longer without her. I mean, she was just a tremendous support to him. He's in very poor shape as it is, and I think we'll be saying goodbye to him before too long. And I think he was a very effective representative of this country, and I hope he is given the respect that he deserves.
Well, again, I thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Donald Gregg, a career CIA officer who served as Vice President George H.W. Bush's National Security Advisor and United States Ambassador to South Korea. In 2007, the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies established a foreign policy fellowship in the ambassador's name, and his latest book is Potsherds, Fragments of a Life Lived in CIA, the White House, and the Two Koreas. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back assessing the new leader of Cuba, the 57-year-old Miguel Diaz-Canel Bermudez. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Havana, Cuba, is Mark Frank, a freelance journalist who works for Thomson Reuters and the Financial Times and consults for ABC News. He has also contributed to The Economist and Argentina's Clarín, and he's the author of Cuba Looks to the Year 2000 and Cuban Revelations Behind the Scenes in Havana. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Frank.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi, Mark. And now that the Cuba's National Assembly has cleared the way for a successor to Raúl Castro, Communist Party official named Miguel Diaz-Canel, what do you know about him, the 57-year-old? He's been groomed, I believe, for this role for some time.
Yeah, well, you know, we know quite a bit about him. It's just not necessarily what we would like to know. Basically, he's someone who's come up through the party. He's a party cadre who's worked his way up through the ranks and is tried, tested, and true. So he's someone that they like the work he's done. He's gone through lots of time to see if he has any problems. He does not seem particularly, you know, personally ambitious. He seems very loyal. And so they basically have some confidence in him here that he'll continue the revolution.
And the vote to ratify his nomination, or to approve, I guess, his nomination, that's supposed to be held today, is it not?
Yeah, basically, they did hold the vote today, but they're going to announce it tomorrow morning. And there's only one candidate, him, so it's obviously going to be him.
Right.
And then, you know, we expect a few speeches from Raúl Castro, who will be stepping down, from Diaz-Canel, who has to talk a little bit about his vision and what he sees in the future.
So the fact that he's been groomed for a long time and that he's a proven sort of party loyalist, is that to say that he's not particularly original, I guess? I'm trying to think of a better way to describe it. Somebody that's likely to break from the mold of Fidel Castro and then his brother Raúl?
Well, it really depends what you mean. He's certainly not somebody who's about to throw in the towel in terms of what they perceive as their independence. And he's certainly not somebody who's going to kind of dump the model of a socialist economy. But he is somebody who's going to preside, as Raúl has, over a gradual opening of the country in many different ways, socially and economically, while continuing with the one-party system. So we'll certainly continue to see gradual change in Cuba, as we've been seeing now for 10 years, but nothing dramatic.
Well, but do you equate socialism with the future of the country? Is that the calling card? You mentioned independence. Those are different words, but do they mean somewhat the same thing?
In their view, they do, because their view is, say, they're a small little country to us, and the only way they can be independent is to have a different type of economy. But I think they also believe that their economy is a more just economy. They're not big fans of capitalism. They're learning to live with capitalism because that's where the world is, but that doesn't mean they're big fans of it or ready to, you know, basically become a capitalist country. They're ready to make concessions like they've been making now for quite a while, really since the Soviets fell, but they're not ready even to go to the lengths of China in terms of a market socialism.
Well, when you say that, you know, they're trying to accommodate to capitalism, all of the reports one's ever heard from Cuba, and including talking to people who've visited, nobody's ever said that they have a robust economy. It may be much fair. It is obviously much fairer in terms of distribution of wealth, but that's not to say it's functioning particularly well. Is there any marked improvements? I know the Trump administration have rolled back some of the opening. I don't know whether that's impacting its economy. Obviously, when the Russians left, they suffered an enormous blow. So give us a sense of...
Again, I think it's not a black and white issue. If you look at it in terms of kind of the macro economy and the GDP, they're not doing very well at all in terms of the agricultural production. In general, even though they've instituted a number of reforms, those reforms have not produced what they expected it to produce. At the same time, you can look at it in another way and say that's all true, but it's also true that we now have more and more internet, more and more cell phones, more and more hooking up the government slowly but surely to the digital revolution. We now have a fairly robust tourism industry, and we can go on from there too. So it's a mixed bag, but yes, in terms of the overall economy, it's still in very serious trouble, as everybody knows. But their answer to that is to attract more foreign investment, not to have internal development of capitalism, at least at this point.
So in terms of then internal reforms or the lack thereof, we just touched on the economic side. What about the political side? Any chance of any pluralism? It's always going to be a one-party state. And with the opening up with more of the internet, is there any likelihood of more diversity, not just state media, but alternative forms of information?
Sure. Well, on the second part, first of all, on the one-party system, they've said they're going to tweak it to try to make it more responsive, but they have no intention of dumping it, be that Diaz Canal or anybody else. Nobody has suggested in the leadership of the country ever, actually, that they're going to dump it. At the same time, never say never, because the world's a complicated place and the future, one never knows. But certainly for the moment, you can expect the one-party system to continue. In terms of diversity of views, of ability to express your views, of the internet, it's like night and day here already. So, yes, it's not the United States, but the level of, you know, independent journalism, independent blogs, discussion both on the internet and, in fact, even in the mainstream media, is quite robust by Cuban standards.
And in terms of the fact that apparently Díaz-Canel resisted the Communist Party pressure to shut down a newly established meeting place in Havana for gays and lesbians, is that something that would indicate he's socially more liberal than the Castro brothers?
Yeah, sure. He's another generation. First of all, the place was actually in Villa Clara when he was head of the party there, which was 20 years ago, about a long time ago. But even then, it was attracting gay people, and it was a big scandal then compared to what it would be now. And he went right in there, defended it, took his kids there. and everything else. So he certainly has a reputation in that sense. He's also intervened at times to protect Cuban state journalists when they've gotten in trouble for being too outspoken. So I'm sure he's more liberal than the old-timers in terms of all kinds of social issues. I talk to the Cuban journalists all the time, and he meets with them quite a bit. And they all just, you know, tickled pink that he walks around with a tablet and knows how to use it. I mean, and they all think he's very supportive of a much more aggressive, you know, public journalism on the part of the Cuban media.
And earlier I mentioned how Cuba suffered enormously when the Russians sort of dropped them cold and their oil subsidies, et cetera, disappeared and the country had to improvise. Maybe that's a precursor for what we should be doing to get off carbon and oil. But Hugo Chavez stepped in with subsidized oil from Venezuela. And, of course, Cuba has a very close relationship with Venezuela. As far as we know, I don't know that Díaz-Canel, he spent a lot of time in Nicaragua, did he not? Has he had much connections to Venezuela?
Yeah, of course he has. The entire leadership of Cuba has had, you know, constant interaction with the leadership of Venezuela from the time Chavez, you know, became head of the country. It was that in 1998, I believe, no? Until now. And so basically, he's had massive contact with all the leadership there and everything else, either when they visit here, he's visited there, et cetera. So he and Cuba feels very loyal to Venezuela for a lot of reasons. So he's not going to change their support for Venezuela.
But I think in all fairness and objectivity, isn't Venezuela becoming a basket case? Isn't it an oil-rich country that's been grossly mismanaged? My understanding is the Cubans have extraordinary influence there. So is that a case of a kind of ideological dogma getting in the way of running a country?
Well, you know, what I would say is this. Hugo Chavez and his, you know, revolution, right, did a great deal for Cuba, and not just economically, but in terms of breaking the kind of the political circle in Latin America. You know, it was like nobody dared be nice to Cuba type of thing. And he totally busted that open. So they feel quite a debt to Venezuela in terms of a certain period in their history after the fall of the Soviet Union. And these people are very, very loyal people. And so, you know, even if they felt that things were a basket case, even if they felt that they couldn't do much there, they would never publicly go against Venezuela as long as, you know, the people who are called Chavistas are in power because of all the things they feel that they did for Cuba. So even separate from the economic interests and really their kind of geopolitical view of the region, there's also the, you know, the loyalty factor, which they actually take very seriously. So, you know, for all those reasons, I mean, if you want, you could look at it as, you know, being in quicksand and you can't get out. So what are you going to do? Or, you know, whatever. But the idea that they're going to separate from the Chavistas just doesn't jive with who these people are and who they've always been.
But does it indicate that the Cuban economic model is doomed to failure if that's what the Venezuelans are operating on?
Well, the Venezuelans' model was never the Cuban model. Now it's becoming more one now that it's failed. I mean, when oil prices fell 80%, their economy was still mainly a capitalist economy. Yes, they had taken over the oil and some of the industries, but I mean, it's not, you know, there's a large private sector, at least there was, in Venezuela. So I would say now they're getting closer to the model, now that they're in a basket case. But I don't think you can just blame the model, because they never really had the same model as Cuba.
I see.
Cuba's model doesn't work here, let alone in Venezuela. So, you know, I don't know if you can really, it's such a different situation. Economically, I mean, in Venezuela, there's large private businesses. historically, up until very recently at least, and, you know, private media, all kinds of things that don't exist in Cuba, and now maybe don't exist in Venezuela. But when the crisis happened, Venezuela was still very much a mixed economy.
Well, Mark Frank, I very much appreciate your time, and I thank you for joining us, filling us in on secession underway in Havana, Cuba.
A pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Frank, who's a freelance journalist based in Cuba, who works for Thomson Reuters and the Financial Times and consults for ABC News and has contributed to The Economist and Argentina's Clarín and is the author of Cuba Looks to the Year 2000 and Cuban Revelations, Behind the Scenes in Havana. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how the new Cuban leader can meet the expectations of young Cubans who want the government's social services but want the government off their back. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Anne-Louise Bardak, a Penn USA award-winning journalist and author of Cuba Confidential and Without Fidel, A Death Foretold in Miami, Havana, and Washington, as well as the editor of The Prison Letters of Fidel Castro and Cuba, A Traveler's Literary Companion. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anne-Louise Bardak.
Thank you.
And I just spoke to a reporter in Havana, and obviously tomorrow there's no doubt about Miguel Díaz-Canel being the new leader, even though they took a vote today. There's no mystery. It's a sort of an inside job, I guess. But your latest article at The Guardian is Raul takes a bow, meaning that Raul Castro, even though he's 86 years old, is not exactly exiting the scene altogether. How much is he going to be operating from the shadows?
I would say quite a bit. Remember, Raul is still fit, reasonably healthy, and Cuba has long run on a gerontocracy. At one point, the average age of the Politburo was into their 80s. Raul, to his credit, has sought to rejuvenate that somewhat. And you can say that the ascension of Miguel Díaz-Canel, who's all of 57, is his most visible offering to revivify the Cuban political culture. But Raul will remain the head of the Cuban Communist Party. So that's one of the most central and powerful institutions in Cuba. And very little happens without the assent of the party. So he's very much going to be on the scene, and as has always been his preference, behind, you know, in the wings. But that was always his preference. His brother Fidel loved the limelight, craved the limelight, you know, craved curtain calls, could never leave until he could no longer go on with his health. And Raul was always the reluctant leader, very comfortable with power and running things, but never good as a front man.
Well, the new leader apparently is tech savvy, internet savvy. And does he have an ally in terms of modernizing the economy and getting country more engaged, connected to the world? In Raul Castro's daughter, she's a sort of, I believe, a bohemian and quite a, I guess, for the want of a better description, a reformer?
The problem with Mariela Castro Espín, she's a fascinating, very well-liked figure in Cuba. She pioneered LGBT rights. She pioneered transgendered surgeries. She's a member of the National Assembly, but she's not in the nexus of power. But she definitely put gay rights front and center in Cuba. She started an institute to, ensure that there was always a discussion and some historical rectification about Cuban's machista past. But she's not in the nexus of power. The nexus of power would be her brother, who's a colonel, Alejandro Castro Espín. He's younger, and he is invariably by his brother's side. He's the head of counterintelligence at the Ministry of Interior, but he's much more than that. I mean, that's a hugely powerful job, but he's much more than that. And I think it was very important to the Castros to ostensibly say, look, we're not a dynasty. But the fact of the matter is they are a dynasty. They're the dynasty that's not a dynasty. Fidel moved, stepped aside only when he could no longer hold on to power. He moved his brother, his co-ruler, the head of the armed forces since 1959, the central institution of power in Cuba into the front. And some people will recall that when Fidel stepped aside and Raul tried to modernize the Cuban economy, even just a little here and a little there, Fidel would often undercut him. He would write these columns, these reflexiones, in Granma, in which he would actually undercut his brother's modest reforms. But yes, compared to Fidel Castro, Raul Castro is an economic reformer. He always had his eye on the Vietnamese or Chinese model, and Miguel Díaz-Canel has been his mentee and has handled things exactly right. He has not sought to appear powerful. He has not done any showboating. He has not jumped into the limelight, because there were a whole series of potential heir apparents, all of whom were dismissed or even sent to the pokey or charged with corruption. But this is Raul's handpicked successor. But never forget that his son, Alejandro Castro Espín, is far more powerful, and his son-in-law, Luis Alberto Garcia Rodriguez, he has a very long name, will remain the head of GAYESA. He's a general, and GAYESA is the FARC, the Cuban Armed Forces, cash cow, and the central organ of the Cuban economy. So when you, at the end of the day, you're going to have Raul running the Communist Party, his son running counterintelligence, and his son-in-law running the army's economic behemoth.
Now, you mentioned the gerontocracy. It is very much a struggle, is it not, between the gerontocracy who are holding on to power. And I understand that even though there have been delegations from Vietnam and China visiting, the hardliners or the old-timers, I guess, with the revolution, they've been apparently showing the young people films of critical of the new breed of oligarchs in Russia today, suggesting that if you go too fast and capitalism happens too much, that this is what you get, a bunch of crooks. They've slowed down giving permits to free enterprise activities like restaurants, which were blossoming all over. And, of course, you can't discount the stupidity and reactionary idiocy of the American government under Donald Trump, under influence of the worst of Miami. I mean, there's a real symmetry there, isn't there, between our boneheaded hardliners and the old guard hanging on to the revolution.
Well, Trump's moves were really counterproductive because these modest reforms enacted by Raul Castro as a result of the opening with Barack Obama, that historic opening as one of Barack Obama's final moves, is you have a modest level of private entrepreneurship. So what these restrictions by the Trump administration do is they directly hurt them. That's what they're hurting. They're hurting the private entrepreneurs. Believe me, the big hotels that are controlled by the Cuban army are going to figure out how to get their, you know, work their way around it. You know, they're going to have the wherewithal to, one, withstand it economically and also figure out ways to circumvent. But the small entrepreneurs, the very sector we're supposed to be trying to help to transition Cuba, that's the area that's really been hurt.
Right, and the relatives, people that flew in with all kinds of goodies and money, haven't they slowed down the visa process for Cubans in America visiting Cuba?
Both, yeah. Yeah, they've kind of, you know, they're really curtailing the traffic, which is where you get your ideas, where you can get money. Remember, at this point, there isn't a whole lot of organized opposition to Cuba in Miami. Yes, Marco Rubio wanted to punish the regime. He wanted to slow down Barack Obama's opening. But, you know, even when the Cuban American National Foundation, which was once a hardcore right-wing organization, supported the Obama opening, that tells you that we're really, there is no more big boogeyman in Miami. You know, Rubio did it. He's representing an ever diminishing hardline core. And it's not been popular for Rubio in Florida. It's really, It was not well received by many prominent Cuban groups. It was received by, I would say, a much smaller segment of aging hardliners. So
right. Well, that's the symmetry.
Yeah.
Well, that's the symmetry between the hardliners on both sides. It's just, it's really tragic. But let's talk a little bit about how the new leader, Díaz-Canel, is going to navigate the expectations of the young. They like having social services, but they also want the state to get off their backs. And they've had a bit of a taste of some liberalization and entrepreneurship, which, as you mentioned, Trump has rolled back or impeded, and they've stopped giving licenses to new private enterprises. So that's happening. They've also, the reliance on subsidized oil from Venezuela is drying up because Venezuela is collapsing.
Oh, that's, yeah, absolutely. Well, Venezuela, which once basically picked up the tab for all of Cuba from the 100,000 barrels a day of free oil to the optic cable systems to everything, is that's almost disappeared. I mean, Venezuela under Maduro, who was heavily cultivated by the Castros and their closest allies, that country is close to total collapse. It's close to full economic bankruptcy, and it's hardly in a position to carry a Caribbean island. So Cuba's in a difficult position here because it has it's being hurt with U.S. tourism by the Trump restrictions, and its longtime patron Venezuela, which stepped in to the role that the Russians had for decades, is no longer. So basically, this is an island that is in uncharted territories. Anybody will tell you that the levels of education and health care are steadily eroding. They're not at the levels they once were. And you have an ever-increasing younger population that just wants more. You know, they want more stuff. They want more rights. They want to travel. And they don't see a whole lot of change. Raul and his thinking and the old historicos around him, they are very wary of what the Russians did, perestroika and glasnost, and they move at really tiny incremental steps. And that's not good enough for the majority of Cubans who, you know, want a much more accelerated level of change. At the same time, remember, they're getting less for their ration cards. They're getting less for health care. Everything, because there's less money to pay for a socialist state.
Right, and less tourists as well. So just in the last minute, obviously we also don't have the proper representation under Trump that we had before, but in part there is that problem with these mysterious ailments that American diplomats stationed in Havana have been subject to. Is there any more clarity on that? My understanding is that it's Russian signals intelligence that's been making them sick. So what's happening there, do you know?
Well, you know, there's a great deal of speculation. It's interesting. You know, anybody who knows anything to know about Cuba knows that surveillance is their thing. You know, you talk to Cubans on any trip and everybody goes, shh, they can hear, listening. Everybody, they have succeeded in the way that East Germany did of making people paranoid. but, of course, that's much more vaunted than it actually is. But, yes, the Cubans have been superb in electronic surveillance. However, this mystery as to what has caused numerous Americans diplomats or embassy staffers to go deaf, several of them are virtually deaf now, is somewhat mysterious. If I had to pull a theory out of my hat, for the most likely, it would be what you said, that the Russians, who are well back in Cuba, who are heavily invested again, have been tinkering around and targeting Americans in the way that Russians have been creating a great deal of mischief, whether it's the 2016 election, whether it's messing around with Donald Trump. Certainly Cuba would be an excellent target space for them. And because they are providing some basic aids to Cuba, if the Cubans know that the Russians are doing it, they are going to be very loath to turn them in.
Right.
Remember that the Russians picked up the tab for Cuba for around 40 years, and they are continuing to pick up some tabs, and of course for exchanges for doing surveillance of the United States. So I think that if you had to jump for one likely suspect, it would probably be the Russians creating a little mischief, and the Cubans not being in a position to turn them in.
Well, Anne Louise Dvorak, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate
it. My pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Anne Louise Dvorak, a Penn USA award-winning journalist and author of Cuba Confidential and Without Fidel, A Death Foretold in Miami, Havana, and Washington, as well as the editor of The Prison Letters of Fidel Castro and Cuba, A Traveler's Literary Companion. And the latest article at The Guardian is Raul Takes a Bow. This is Beam Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.